What's up, everybody? Hey, I just wanted to take an opportunity before we even start this podcast to say thank you to all of our members out there, everybody that has stayed signed on, especially through this crazy pandemic that we're in. I know that like money's tight and a lot of people out there aren't working. We're working really hard to try to bring as much value as we can to this platform, and I just want to thank all of you. I really appreciate all of you and love all you guys for continuing to support what we do. So thank you again. So this podcast this week, what we did is we actually reached out to one of our good friends across the pond, D. Neil Pritchard. He is a food scientist, and he is the R&D chef for the Fat Duck Experimental Kitchen. We had the opportunity to visit him along with our friend Dustin Salvaggio. We visited last year over in Bray, right outside of London. And super cool experience. We got to visit some of the restaurants, had a tour of the place, but we wanted to reach out to him and kind of get a perspective of how this whole COVID-19 virus is impacting people around the world, and also restaurants outside of the United States. And of course, he has tremendous insight. I asked him a few questions on innovation because I know that when you have an opportunity to talk with somebody like that, the way that they troubleshoot a big adversity, a problem that's so epic as this pandemic, it's really interesting to kind of hear their perspective about how they're dealing with it and what they see restaurants of the future, how they see them changing and adjusting in the years to come. Anyway, enjoy. Thanks so much for watching and listening. We appreciate you. Take care.
We are glad to be able to talk with you. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm surviving. Anyway,
so yeah,
I've got my Corona beard.
I like it. Very nice thing, so.
Well, so this is the first time that we've done this, and obviously, like since this has happened, this whole crisis. I know I've been asked, a lot of people have been doing podcasts and webinars and all sorts of different stuff. And Zoom, their stock has gone up like in the last like 24 hours. And I think there's going to be more and more people that are going to be meeting like this and stuff like that. But as you may know, we have our online website, Rosendale Online, but we're also making a lot of this stuff for free. We're going to be putting stuff on YouTube and just sharing with a lot of our community. And also, too, we have been trying to talk with as many people just to see what things that we can kind of learn from how this is impacting everybody else and what we might be able to all kind of gain from listening to each other. And we thought that we'd kind of reach out to you. We talked to Dustin, and he said that he'd reach out to you. So thank you for doing this. I think what we could do is I'm going to make introductions for everybody just so that later when everybody's watching, if they got questions, they'll be able to see exactly who's all involved in this. So D. Neil Pritchard is the R&D manager at the Fat Duck Group and chef and really food scientist, really. And whenever we were out there, we did a tour last year, out in Bray, where the Fat Duck is located. You were gracious enough to kind of give us a behind the scenes and really kind of see the whole operation and kind of toured London, which was, I don't know, that was, we went over for Boku's Door, but that was really one of the highlights for us. And we had an awesome time hanging out with you. And of course, next to me, based in Miami, we got Christopher Ryloff, our corporate chef with Rosendale Collective. Dustin Salvaggio, who has done a lot of collaborations with us, some classes and other cooking events, is also kind of really a guru as it relates to food science, kind of a walking encyclopedia of equipment and stuff like that. So we thought be a perfect person to kind of talk with on this particular topic. Daniel, if you would, I think before we kind of get into some of the COVID questions, can you maybe just tell everybody just kind of your background, how you kind of, your path to where you are today?
Well, it's kind of quite a stereotypical chef background at the start. I dropped out of school like a lot of chefs, and I was already working like 30 hours a week in restaurants, washing up, kind of doing the cold section in the pubs and I just kind of fell into it from there, and I realized at a certain point that it was what I wanted to do because of the challenge, I suppose. I did a lot of sport when I was younger. I was quite competitive, and I really liked that feeling of coming out of service and feeling like it was the end of a game, a tough game of sport, and you've been challenged and you've met that challenge, and then you were learning at the same time. And I think as I got a bit older, I realized that I probably needed more education. I'm quite a curious person, so I applied to do a food science degree. Did a food science degree, and from there went back into the kitchen for my sins, which isn't what most people do. but it was kind of like the dream role. How do I learn all this stuff and apply it in a way where purely focusing on people's pleasure, right? In a fine dining restaurant, you just want to make people happy in whatever way you can. In a more commercial setting, it can sometimes be more difficult because things come into it more in terms of money and scale and compromise, especially if you're turning out 500,000 ready meals a week, a year, whatever it is. So it's definitely the side of the industry I wanted to go in. And then that's taken me from there. I've now been about 8 years in my current role. So.
Well, I mean, I know a lot of the stuff that we saw when we were there, you could see where somebody that doesn't have that science background, this isn't, I mean, the way that you think and the way that you cook, I mean, you really kind of have to have an understanding of the properties of all the ingredients and everything that you're working with. So not everybody's going to have that kind of depth and experience. So I find that just extremely fascinating. Now that we kind of have an understanding of just like with your background, I think naturally, like what everybody's kind of focused on right now is this whole COVID-19 impact. You've seen obviously from afar, like all the stuff that's kind of happening in the United States, and we can tell you how devastating it's been for like restaurants here, hotels. I mean, I don't think in all of my years, I mean, for everybody, you haven't seen anything. Even the tragedy with 9/11, at least in the United States, that has had such a profound, immediate impact on the entire industry. I mean, it literally has turned the hospitality industry upside down. What have you seen in London? I mean, what's it like with restaurants there? Like how fast and like what have you seen?
I mean, I kind of follow the news quite a bit, so I kind of saw it coming. But literally, everybody's world just turned upside down in a week. I mean, it went very quickly. You know, you're seeing the rest of the world kind of, it was growing, and we kind of felt something was coming, and the figures were rising. And then I think it was, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think on the few days between kind of social distancing and then lockdown, and it was basically, I remember on a Monday evening, I think the Prime Minister just said, Friday evening, Prime Minister said, every restaurant has to be shut that isn't doing takeaway by Saturday night at the latest. And in some ways it was a huge relief to know that was going to happen, you know, because there's a lot of steps all around the country, and, you know, a lot of places in London, they just shut, let people go. And there was a lot of fear in the industry, and I think really luckily in the UK, the government announced that they were going to subsidise our wages. They're calling it furlough, which is quite a strange word, not very common, but effectively we're put aside and you get up to 80% of your wage to a maximum of £2,500.
Okay.
So it's actually a fairly good amount of money. Most people should be okay. So it took a lot of the pressure off because I think people were scrambling to look at different ways they could pivot. I suppose pivot is the word.
Right.
And took that pressure off. The thing that became apparent after is that tips aren't included. So I know the US system is a lot different, but even so, the service charge in London, you know, say it's 10-12%, something like that, it's normally put on the bill. Generally, in most of the fine dining restaurants, automatically, and then you get the choice, you know, it's optional. So that 12.5% generally feeds into top up everyone's wages from minimum wage. So So that is a huge part of people's wages. I have no idea what sort of percentage, but 80% of 60% of your wages actually then means that some people are going to be really struggling. But we do have a minimum amount of income that's keeping people going.
So that sounds like that's kind of carved out for the workers. But, you know, what about the people that own like the pubs and the small mom and pop restaurants? I mean, is there anything that's actually for the businesses themselves?
So we have like a local tax, local government and national government. I think the local government have given business rates relief, which is kind of an amount of money that you pay to the council just to operate a business within their area. And there's a lot of relief for the industry in that way, but I think they've been quite slow to kind of deal it out. And then there's a lot of business loans, but I think the banks aren't really handing that money. So I think a lot of business owners are really struggling to understand how they're going to keep going. I think some of the figures look scary. I don't know about your side of the pond, but you know, there's people saying 40, 50%, 30%, you know, a huge number of the restaurants in the UK are not going to reopen according to some predictions.
Wow.
So that's going to change the world we live in drastically. So.
Yeah, it sounds like there are a lot of parallels to like what you guys are experiencing and exactly like what we're facing here in the United States. Dustin, let's maybe we'll go around the horn here and just ask some questions if you want to go first.
Sure. You know, Daniel, good to see you again. It's been a while. Being that you guys are one of the most technologically advanced operations and you have a lot of systems in place with that machinery to kind of aid in the process and keep things efficient and consistent. Do you look at that as a saving grace when you guys go back after reopening and as a way to kick back into the regular routine and something that other restaurants could adapt to make the struggle a little bit easier?
Yeah, I think technology can certainly help. I think people are going to have to reevaluate all of their systems and labor in the food industry is huge, right? I remember way back when I did a college course, it was, you know, it's the one third, one third, one third kind of split, you know, so it's, if your wages are one third of, you know, 30% say of what you take, then if you can cut some of that back, it might help with the operating costs. And technology is always going to help. I think that, I think probably, my opinion is that I've worked at many different levels in this industry, and I think what we're really great at is when you're in the weeds, and we've all been there, when you're there, it's you make it happen, right? So I think that we've got an amazing, resilient workforce that can make things happen. It's just how the economics work out and how many people are going to have jobs to go to. So technology is a huge part of that, and so is the artistry of a chef, right? The skill of delivering something with the same impact with maybe cheaper ingredients. Or
there's also the conversation we had about what is our kitchen going to look like when we get back? How many people are going to be allowed in it? Are we going to still have shoulder to shoulder commies, or is there going to be half the workforce allowed in a workspace? So what does that look like? You know, how do we combat that? How do we use that to our advantage?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of some of, you know, some of the more prep-heavy businesses, you might have to do some sort of rota, which means night shifts, right? Which means people are going to be doing all the mise en place. You split the team in two, and you have a mise en place team working an early shift or a night shift, and they're kind of pushing out as much as possible. And you have a service team, or maybe even two service teams, and try and rebalance that way. But I don't think anyone really knows how the virus behaves yet. I think we're still so in the dark with it that no one, you know, in the UK, we're not encouraged to use face masks. The rest of the world seems to be
really
pretty heavily encouraged to use face masks. And the UK government said the science doesn't prove that they really have that much benefit unless someone has symptoms, in which case they should be at home and not leaving anyway. So I think an evidence-based approach to that is going to have to be done, and it's such a changing situation. I can't even begin to think about how to put that in place, I suppose.
I have a question, and then we'll, and then I'm sure Chris will have one as well. Is somebody spending time with you whenever we were over there? I could tell, like, the way your mind works is you're a very innovative person, and almost I look at that as a problem solver. You know, so like a lot of times whenever you come up with an idea for something new, a lot of times that is stems from maybe trying to be innovative, but maybe you're also trying to solve a problem. So I wonder from like the innovator's mind, if there's something that a small restaurateur in America can look at what this situation is asking of them, which is, hey, when you reopen, you're going to have to make a lot of changes. So if you were like a restaurateur in America, like what, how would you get ready to reopen? I mean, do you feel like there are opportunities now for somebody to look at the traditional restaurant model? Like where would you be looking at right now if you owned a restaurant and you were getting ready to reopen in a post-pandemic world? How does somebody with your kind of mindset, like what would you maybe recommend to focus on for somebody?
I'm quite analytical, and I do love to solve problems. So there's one thing I've discovered, and I think it might be something in the recruitment world, but it's called T-shaped people. So I don't know if you've ever heard of this concept, but if you line up all the skills in a row of what's required for a job, you know, say it's a chef, and you have, you know, maybe your palate is one of those key skills. You know, you'll have two or three skills that you're better at than anyone else, and you have a bunch of skills that you're not so good at. Right, so they're very specialized roles, and you kind of, a restaurant can also be looked at in the same way, right? So if you own a business, and there's a perfect example is a restaurant in London that was amazing called Hedone, or Hedone. And their bread was out of this world, and their food was amazing. But unfortunately, they closed the restaurant business, but they opened a bakery because the rest of London wanted their bread because it was the best bread in any restaurant in London. And you can kind of sit down and you analyze who you are. What are your unique skills? What is it that you do better than anyone else? And then you can look at that and analyze it and go, how do I apply this? Where else can I apply this? Put myself in the customer's position. Where else would I want an amazing loaf of bread? Right now, I just ordered a sourdough online last week. I put half of it in the freezer, but that sourdough has come from a bakery in London and been sent to me. And that is the sort of opportunities that you can create for yourself. And every restaurant has that. There's people with unique skills. There's amazing cocktail makers, there's amazing service people. We have some people that I've worked with in this one girl, Joanna. She was an amazing calligrapher and artist, and she's just done a cookbook called the Isolation Cookbook. Very, very quick, not a big cookbook, but she's kind of done the drawings, and a chef she used to work with has done a bunch of recipes, and they've self-published, and it's kind of gone ballistic. They sold out in a couple of hours, and that sort of thing is about just adapting and kind of just go for it. You know, if you could start small, it's that kind of startup mentality of, you know, what do we do well and who could possibly want it, and let's see if they want it. And I think that attitude of just trying things, you know, just be prepared to fail and just
go. Do you think that a lot of restaurants, really across everything from full service to higher end, I mean, do you think that in the future, kind of like what you were alluding to, almost kind of like finding out like what you really do well, do you think that maybe there's an opportunity to maybe kind of narrow the focus and maybe, like, for example, do you need to have an entire eight different desserts, or maybe for a small restaurant, maybe you just offer a really great chocolate one and a really great fruit-based one, and it changes more frequently? I mean, do you think that maybe kind of narrowing the focus on what a restaurant offers maybe to, I guess to kind of cut expenses. I mean, in the United States, that's one of the things that we're faced with is that with this social distancing, somebody may have a restaurant lease that they were leased 5 years ago that said, hey, you can do 400 covers in here. Well, it's like now that lease is almost kind of voided because the law says, you know, now the new restrictions are is that I can only put half of that in. So it's almost like we're kind of going into uncharted territory that you almost got to kind of look back at your business plan and really try to, like you said, maybe just focus on the things that you're really good at.
Yeah, and I think in these uncertain times, I think the pressure, I mean, I haven't owned a business, but the pressure of owning a business, which I'm sure you're feeling right now, and is quite strong, right? And I think one key thing that's always led me in my work is what energizes you, what rewards you, because those things, they don't feel like work. So I love to solve problems. If I go into work and I get badgered with problems and I can solve them all day, I finish work and I'm so happy and I don't feel like anything is hard. And I think it's kind of, those are the things you can focus on. It's also how, you know, you could find that business model, but it could be that you really want to be creative and you really want to put eight desserts on. So how is it that you can switch to two and then it absolutely kills you inside to run a business that probably is going to struggle to make profit anyway, I suppose.
So, right.
I think those decisions are pretty tough. I think everyone is going to have to scale back on what they deliver. A lot of talk around with chef's friends here in the UK is everyone saying that they're going to have to scale back more away from fine dining, more casual, quicker eating times, whether that means turning tables, and just dial it all back a little bit and start afresh and see what the market is. Because I think, you know, I've been reading this book called The Plague.
That's kind of timely. Yeah.
Which is a book by Camus, and it's about being in lockdown in I think it's Algeria.
Really?
And it's really interesting in terms of the psychology of it. And I find that I've lost my point completely.
Actually, I was going to ask you if you're reading any interesting books, but that was kind of that's a timely one, I guess.
I think in terms of a personal well-being, and I know well-being is a bit of a buzzword, I think doing that analysis of yourself and what makes you happy and what interests you, and doing that is a hugely beneficial thing you can do in terms of a lot of restaurants I've worked in, you're in work 12, 16 hours a day. You don't have time for a life. A lot of people are probably struggling right now from the industry because they don't know what to do with their time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Aged up when they're used to this kind of crazy life of responding constantly and analyzing kind of yourself like that can let you know where you want to go. Because I think with this situation, I think it's everybody's going to reevaluate who they are and what they want to do. And if jobs are difficult to come by, and if restaurants do end up only hiring half the staff back, then those people are going to have to kind of evaluate what it is they want to do and where they want to go and whether they want to return to their old life, I suppose. And best thing I've done is, and I didn't even plan to do it, is I wrote down like a mise en place list. And it's a daily mise en place list, which I would kind of do, especially if I was on a section, quite a repetitive section at work. You write a schedule, right? I get in, make a cup of tea or a coffee, and then I do this job and this job and this job and this job and this job. And then if I do all that by 11 o'clock, I can have a cigarette and maybe something to eat before I start service, right? But I did that, and I've pretty much stuck to it. And I think that routine just kind of helps you with the rigor of being rudderless, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Well, you left an impact on me whenever I was out there, and with the tea. I mean, you brought the tea up, and you made some tea for us, and then we went into, I think, postcard teas, I believe it was.
Oh, yeah.
But I have ordered from them now twice. And I've ordered from them, and it looks like Chris has got some. Yeah, I got quite the collection now. So that was that was awesome. That was a really cool moment walking through the store.
I think that's another thing I've tried to do as much as possible is that I don't have much money to spend on food, but I'm trying to support the businesses that matter to me. So there's like a local coffee shop I made sure I went to. There's Neil's Yard Cheese in London. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Probably the premier cheese company in the UK, and a lot of the artisan people that produce cheese in the UK are really struggling because, you know, the lead time on cheese, you know, something like a cheddar can be 12 months old at least. And these people have got lead time set up to come into spring, summer to supply cheese, and the market's gone, right? And they have no market.
Wow.
And this was all going to industry, and it's the same across all of the artisans. So I've tried to order from some specialist suppliers that I really think I want to keep. And I think that's a message. Again, in the reverse, is that if you aren't in the industry or if you're a supplier, maybe try and do something to support some of the restaurant businesses out there. I know a lot of them have got funding pages and allow you to buy vouchers, or they're doing takeouts. You know, the ones that you're going to really miss if they're not there anymore, try and support them as much as possible. So maybe just eat some beans on the other day. Be surprised.
Christopher, question?
Yeah. So hey, Daniel, thank you again for the tour that you gave us whenever we were over there. I think it was great, and we are still talking about it. And Facebook, it was funny because a couple of weeks ago, you just reminded us like some of the pictures that we were taking. All of those places that we went. It was great. I know that pretty much everyone is talking about like how the restaurant like industry is gonna survive and everything. And I think I'm one of those people that I like to, that probably, I mean, most of you are too. I mean, I can talk how is Rich is like that, Dustin too, that most of the people, they like to take care of their own people, but everyone is only talking about how the restaurant is gonna survive. And I would like to know, like, from your perspective, not just where you work, but what is in your mind about, like, what would you suggest to all of the cooks and all of the chefs and people in the industry that they lost their jobs already? So what should they do? And at the same time, it's like everyone is talking about how are you going to go back to work in the restaurant, how the restaurant is going to still working after that we agree that is going to be totally different. But what do you think that people should be doing right now if they lost their job, if they are still working, and how they can, for example, that you just said, I was reading this book, so keep the motivation by reading books, watching YouTube videos or something like that. I know that your background and Dustin's background, I love that. That is science. And at the same time, I've been watching like so many like different kind of stuff from every kind of industry. And it's weird for me that everyone talk about just how the industry is going to survive. But what about the people? I know for a fact that the most of the hotels around here, they already, I don't know, they lay off probably over 5,000 and maybe more people. So what you think that they should do by now and maybe later? I don't think that this is going to go, we're not going to go over this for 3 months. I think it's going to be way longer than that. I mean, we already know that Asia is still fighting the virus. And they have been with the virus for probably, I don't know, around 5 months already. And for us, I think that it's going to take a little bit longer. I was just reading this morning that there is places in Asia. I have a couple of friends in Indonesia and Thailand and Singapore. And they said that the virus already started to change and it can survive in the air. It's not just in droplets right now. So what do you think that should like people do right now to keep the motivation that is really hard for most of them?
Yeah, I think I've been very lucky. That's always what's driven me. And like I said, it's easy when it's what you want to do, right? And I mean, nobody is going to have this amount of time again to probably in their life to be able
right.
to sit down and mm-hmm. have these thoughts and understand maybe a bit better about who they are. I mean, it's something someone shared the other day. There's like a, the Science of Wellness course, I think at Yale University, that they're doing for free right now. And there's things like that that I think help you to understand who you are, right? And what your possible failings or the beauty of who you are. And I think there's a bit of that that everyone's going to have to do. And in that book I mentioned, the one by Camus, there's this weird situation where people are stuck in kind of three different zones of thinking. And one's kind of like that denial stage of, oh, it'll be over soon, I'm just going to keep going. And the other one is kind of living in the present, which is just, I'm just going to ignore everything and just do the things I have to do to keep busy. And then right. The third one is, you know, overly planning for the future when realistically you can't predict what the future is. So I think for me, there's, you know, if there's very specific things, if you are that T-shaped person, if there's very specific things that you can do, if you are a shit hot baker, now's the time to be making some recipes, making it into a book, or finding someone out there who's going to open your bakery. Because if all of the restaurants fold, there's going to be so much property. And if you are that good, then now's the time to really open a business in some ways, because it'll be the cheapest if you can find the investment to do it. And just try and center yourself, I suppose, to what, you know, it's your own well-being, whatever that is. I've been working out twice a day, I've been reading, I've been listening to music. All of these things, just, they don't just occupy my time. They're things that I want to do more of that I haven't. And some of that, I've bought some really probably stupid books now, because I've bought 15 books. And some of them are a bit adventurous, in terms of, I've got The Prince by Machiavelli, Beyond Good and Evil by Nietzsche, and The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And it's like, I will never get the chance to read those books in a normal situation, because it takes too much brain power, right? You're normally so focused on the things you have to focus on. So whether I get around to all of them, I'm not sure. But it's how you kind of upgrade, you know, I'm looking to upgrade my mind, my body, and my life effectively, you know, my emotions. And I think that's a really good way personally to look inside yourself about what to do. And then taking it on from that more practically, like I said, I think hospitality is about giving people positive emotions, right? So if you keep breaking down to whether it's a donut from Dunkin' Donuts or an In-N-Out burger or a free Michelin star restaurant, everybody goes there for some sort of reward mechanism, right? So if you can break things down to say, this is what I do, I make people happy. You know, there's doctors out there that are doing amazing jobs, but I make people happy and I do it through the medium of food. So how do I want to do that? How do I want to really make people happy? And could you make people happy right now? I know some friends, sourdough's gone crazy in the UK. Everybody seems to be learning to make sourdough. Yeah. And people are just dropping off at other people's doors, or someone I know is swapping flour for bread. So people drop them flour and they'll make bread and give it back the sourdough and those sort of things. You know, you could upgrade your skills in cooking as well, right? Not just thinking about how to make people happy and what that is in the restaurant sphere, but you know, I've been making kimchi, I've been kind of doing lots of Asian food, I did okonomiyaki, I've been working on some kind of stuff about just trying to learn how to cook simpler, right? What I tend to do normally is that I chuck a million ingredients in and a million processes, and I made a lasagna the other day. I couldn't leave the sofrito out, but I didn't peel the celery. And every part of my brain from that rigorous training was like, you've got to peel the celery. and then I did that, and I challenged myself to kind of think about what that means. And I ate it, and you wouldn't tell that celery wasn't peeled, right? And a lot of places, they do these steps because that's the proper way to do it. And I think actually, while you're not tasting that food at the level you've been tasting, then you need to connect with food, right? So you need to eat food and understand why you do everything and what you're doing, what effect it has. If I got loads of stringy bits of celery in my teeth, I would know from now on, always peel your celery. What I know now is that if you're going to do a sofrito, it doesn't matter so much if you peel your celery. Right? So it's those sort of things and connecting. I mean, So I was looking into odor again quite a bit recently, and obviously with the odor loss from COVID-19, some friends who are in the industry, chefs, were ill for a bit, and it was quite a few months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, before it really officially kicked off, and they lost their sense of smell for 3 or 4 weeks. Like, if you're a chef, wow, and you've got no sense of smell, then they have no other symptoms. And there's a really good couple of charities called Absent and Fifth Sense that deal with smell loss. And one of the things I learned through them is that your sense of smell, whether you're a sommelier or front of house or back of house, your sense of smell is like a muscle, right? So you need to reinforce the memory of what smells are. So it's a really fun thing to do just to get better, you know, like a sommelier trains on wine by identifying characteristics. When you eat, just try and identify all the smells. Smell ingredients more, upgrade your nose. You know, everyone has worked with that chef who seems to have an unbelievable nose, and they can tell what that ingredient is that everyone else around the table is. What is that? What have they added there? And it's some obscure spice, and someone just goes, "It's that." So, do you want to be that person? Try and train that, and work that muscle, and it's really interesting.
I have, for me, I just have like two last questions for you, and we want to be respectful of your time and kind of wrap things up. But I would say, I would want to ask you, like, what you think is the most underrated ingredient in the kitchen? And then number two, is there a junk food that you really love and crave that we'd be surprised to expect somebody of your caliber that you might have in your pantry, something you love, something you like.
Yeah, well, the funniest thing is that we had discussions a while ago, and Heston said that water is the most underrated ingredient in the
kitchen. Wow!
And actually, when you think about it, it's probably the most commonly used. You just don't think about it because it doesn't necessarily season or add flavour, but probably the most underrated for me. Oh, I don't know.
It's interesting. But it's true at the same time.
The water's pretty interesting.
I wasn't expecting that.
No, it's not. And it's like, you know, at first I was kind of dismissive, and I was thinking, is there something else like butter or salt that you kind of use?
I like the water. I think I'll take the water as a good.
Yeah.
Is there a junk food, something that you eat that we'd be surprised to see somebody like you eating?
there's loads. I mean, the thing, like I said, is that it comes back to pleasure, right? And there's certain things, like I had something that I hadn't had for years, which goes back to when I was a kid, and that in Wales we have tin spaghetti, and it's like spaghetti and tomato sauce in a can.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
In Wales we seem, I don't know if it is a Wales thing, but we seem to use it in replacement for like beans, for like Heinz beans. So many a time in my childhood, I have a full English breakfast with spaghetti instead of beans. But there's one thing I used to do, which was Philadelphia cream cheese and a tin of spaghetti on toast. And that is, it doesn't even taste good. there's something about the creaminess of the Philadelphia and the tin spaghetti. But
yeah, and the texture of the toast and everything like that. I could see that working.
Other than that, yeah. curry is huge in the UK. Curry and probably a doner kebab as well. I like a good doner kebab because it's so umami, right? It's just full of umami that it's just got that comfort. So I think it's kind of you're very closed off. If I had I've had some dishes in great restaurants that I've enjoyed. Some of the most, I think I had one in a restaurant in Copenhagen, and it was lungs, glazed lungs, I think lamb's lung with a little bit of sauce, and it was on mashed potato, and they put little dots of onion puree in there, and I think there was some cheese in it, and I literally was eating it, and there wasn't too much lung, and it just tasted like a mix between Lyonnaise potatoes and aligot. Right, it's just like cheesy oniony potato, and that could be wedges or chips with cheese and onion. That could be anything, and it's like this just tastes like that, but it's in this refined way.
Wow,
incredibly delicious, right? And effectively, that's what you look for. I think a lot of the more traditional French restaurants, they have that like rich umaminess in their foods, the meatiness that that is kind of the foundation for it all that you can get in the most basic things, I suppose. So you shouldn't shut yourself off to just making it, you know, quite often, and I'm guilty of this, like I said, over engineering, you can get the same flavor in something much simpler, but it might not be as intellectually challenging because people go to restaurants for that as well. And I mean, the Bocuse d'Or is probably the most challenging thing you can ever cook intellectually, right? There's so much thought that goes into it, so much preparation, the
shape. Oh yeah, over the top, yeah.
And there's no, you know, that dwarfs in some ways the world of flavor, because it has to obviously excel in that world of flavor, but the amount of work that goes into it is unbelievable. And that's the same as fine dining restaurants, right? So it's pure hedonism. I just want to cover a load of women and caviar and drinks. Edit that bit out.
Well, that's a good way to kind of top things off. I know we're kind of coming up here on our 45 minutes. So, Daniel, we really value your friendship, and we hope that your entire team and friends and family are all safe and get through this together. And hopefully, in not too distant future, we'll see you again soon. You know, you're always welcome over here in the States. And again, thank you for all the hospitality that we enjoyed whenever we were over there. And just, you know, be safe. And thanks for your time today.
No problem. And Daniel, if there is anything that we can do to either support any of your ideas or just like because you need help, you know that we're always here. And just text us or send us an email, anything, whatever you want. And we're going to be more than happy to help.
Yeah, and I think that sense of community is quite key in the industry, and it's there for everybody. Just got to reach out. And yeah, it's been a pleasure. I hope I can help in some way. I love to philosophize on these things anyway. Generally, I enjoy it. So I just hope that, you know, some positivity comes out of it, and everyone stays safe out there. So.
Yeah.
Hopefully next time it's with some pints and Bray.
Yeah, just one or two. But,
yeah, we look forward to that.
Definitely.
Thanks, Daniel. Take care, buddy.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.